So last week, we ended with talking about the battle there at the bridge where Constantine thought he had a vision, maybe did, we don't know, where he then quickly painted up the cross or the Cairo on his instruments of war, and he did win the battle. And of course, then that started the whole idea of the church and state working together and the Edict of Milan and so forth. And so you had the church and state then working together. Some of the Constantinian changes, of course, we talked about the Edict of Milan in 313. It was a toleration of the Christian church, Christianized the military through baptism, dealt with the Donatist, Constantine did, and I'm going to talk just a little bit about that because when the Anabaptists started their movement, they were called Donatist. And why was that? Why were they called Donatist? Well, it was a very derogatory term. And he would have, what happened was, to sum it all up as quickly as possible, in North Africa, the persecution during the time of Diocletian that we talked about last week was severe, but maybe not quite as bad in some areas as others where they were not necessarily executed for their faith. Sometimes they were asked to give up their holy books or something, and that was satisfactory. Sometimes the guys that came couldn't read, and they'd give them some other books. They thought they got holy books, and off they went. Others in the church said, well, that's dishonest, even if it's not right. And those who actually gave up the holy books or recanted were basically called traitors in their language. They were traitors. After Constantine, some of those people then would come back into the church or when after there was not so much persecution. And there was a bishop there that had been ordained by another bishop who, during that time of persecution, had given up some holy books, I believe is what he had done. And so then there was a group who felt like the bishop who had been giving out the emblems, the Eucharist, been baptizing people and so forth, those were not legitimate because he had had his charge given by a man who had given up holy books during the persecution. And so if the leader was not perfectly holy, anything that he done or anyone that he ordained and so forth and so on down, I mean, you could spread that across the whole church and then nobody's duly ordained because somebody way back yonder wasn't perfect. Well, this caused quite a conflict to a point where there were those that separated and actually started fighting each other. And it was an issue that this group, the Donatists, lasted in North Africa for quite a while, but it was a division. Some places they would have a church on one side of the street and a Donatist church on the other side of the street. Not unlike today, too much, but anyway, they had their separation. And so they were outlawed and persecuted by Constantine and, frankly, by some of the other Christians. So not long before, all the Christians are being persecuted, and now it's happening there. So, when we get maybe to 2 weeks from now, maybe we'll talk just a little bit about that connection of why they called the Anabaptists that. But if you think about it, the Anabaptists wanted a complete reform and wanted to get back to actual holy living and living right and believe that your faith changed how you lived, and that was part of that connection. So, he dealt with that. Augustine later, we're going to talk about Augustine some this morning, also opposed the Donatists and did quite a bit of writing about it. Some of the other things is he did print a number of Bibles. He does not outlaw paganism, but he does put money into building some churches, like the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome and so forth. He builds the city of Constantinople, obviously after his name. And after his death, some of his sons, he had some sons that tried to rule. There were conflicts there. That's quite an interesting story if you want to look it up. I will go back to this for just a second. So he had, just to show you how good of a Christian Constantine was after he got converted, through this process of power going on to his children, he had an older son who I don't know what he was up to, but anyway, Constantine had him executed. And then he had three other sons who kind of become the try to rule and later have conflict. And I don't know what was up with their mother, but he had her executed as well. So, you know, just like all good Christians do, let's kill off your family. Anyway, you know how I feel about Constantine and his true beliefs. There was also an Arian controversy that took place, and this is where we get the Council of Nicaea. And if you look in your books, you'll find the Nicene Creed is in the back here among the other creeds. I think it's the first one that's listed among some of the creeds, like the Schleitheim Confession of Faith and the Dortrecht Confession and so forth. Starts off with the Nicene Creed, which is still used today in many circles. The reason for this Nicene Creed was Arius was a deacon in Alexandria, Egypt, and he believed that Christ and the Father were not of the same substance, that Jesus Christ was not God. He was of a different substance. He had to be because he came here physically and so forth, and this became quite a controversy in the church. And Constantine wanted to have unity in the church. Remember, the Romans didn't like a lot of upheaval. They liked things running smoothly. And this Arian controversy started to become a big issue. It was condemned by Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria. And Constantine wants unity, so he convenes a council at Nicaea. Now, this is interesting. At the expense of Constantine or the state, over 300 bishops come to the Council of Nicaea. Basically, the bishops of the known Christian world. They have a record of one coming from as far away as India. They have them coming from Italy and Europe and South Africa and the Mediterranean, the eastern side there of the Mediterranean. All over, these bishops come to decide, who was Christ, and is he God? Was he God? What's going on here? And Constantine actually brings this council together, and actually some people would say presided over it. Some would say he was just there. We don't exactly know his total involvement, but he wanted something to happen. So they met. They meet for several months. They come up with the Nicene Creed. It's not a real long creed, by the way, but it took them a couple of months to get to it. I think it was maybe May through July of that year. And that's where we get the Nicene Creed, is out of that. And I bring that up just because it's important to know that with regard to Constantine and the state church and so forth as we move on. Other developments leading up to the Reformation. And I'm looking at some of these because, again, I think it's important that we understand that the Reformation does not just come out of a vacuum. It's a progressive thing that happens over a period of time. And the next lesson we'll get more directly into, this is how the Swiss, this is the day, this is how they rebaptize, this is why, this is what some of those guys like Blurock and some of those, Felix Mons and those, who they were being taught by and why they went on further with it. But leading up to that, I think there's some things in here that are important. You have the Edict of Thessalonica in AD 380. Theodosius I does that. And he basically says that Nicene Christianity is now the state religion. Now notice it's the Nicene Christianity, which basically outlawed, like the Arian movement and the Diocletians and those, anybody that was not subscribing to the Nicene Creed was on shaky ground and could be eventually persecuted, put out of the church, or whatever. And then we come to a guy by the name of Augustine, or maybe you call him Augustine, whatever you want to call him, the Bishop of Hippo. He lived from AD 354 to 430. In his early life, he was not a Christian, and the reason we're going to talk a little bit about him is you'll see this as we go through. He was an extremely influential figure in the Christian church. Many would argue that next to Christ and maybe Paul, he has influenced the church more than anyone else in church history. And I would tend to agree, and I would tend to agree not for the better. That would be my take on it. So please don't quote him as someone whom you like, okay? You may, that's up to you. Not that he had nothing good to say, but sometimes I hear people quoting Augustine, and I'm like, that's not necessarily the greatest thing. But anyway, in his early life, he was not a Christian. His mother was a Christian, and she prayed for him a lot. His mother's name was Monica, Saint Monica, if you ever see her picture or something. And she prayed for him a lot, but he lived quite a life. At the age of 17, he fathered a child, was not married. He did spend time with that woman for a number of years. Later, they separated. mentioned some of these. Okay, he was a Manichaean for some years, and that religion, basically, the Manichaeans, started by a guy by the name of Manny. He had a little bit longer name, but he was often referred to as that. Manny's parents were members of a Jewish Christian Gnostic sect, which played a part in him. His religion was a mix of Platonism, which if you understand Plato and his philosophies and so forth, he is a real dualist in the sense that the physical world and the spiritual world and like the physical world is bad and so forth, and Gnosticism takes on some of that. So he was kind of a mix of Platonism, Gnosticism, Christianity, and Eastern religions. Okay, that's kind of what the Manichaeans believed. And Augustine was part of that religion for, some would say 7 years, some 10 years. He was part of that religion for a number of years. Eventually kind of got disillusioned with it. A lot of it because he was quite a philosophical person and some things just weren't making sense. And he kind of leaves that. He eventually finds a bishop that he understood and he did convert to Christianity. However, the reason I bring this up, if you look at a lot of his writings and even his influence on the Christian church stems back to a lot of his things that he would have learned and believed under this religion. That's just something to keep in mind. That again, it moves us toward the Reformation, that you've got this influence from Gnosticism and Platonism and Eastern religions that come into a person who is later Christian but doesn't leave all of his beliefs behind. After converting to Christianity, he writes quite a book called The Confessions. You may have heard of that, that he wrote that, and it basically confesses a lot about his life. That's one reason we know so much about him, is he writes a lot about himself. And after the sacking of Rome in 410 by the Visigoths, he writes, and by the way, some people blame the Christians for that, because if we wouldn't have converted to Christianity, we wouldn't have gotten sacked by those Germans up there, basically, is what it amounts to. So, once again, the Christians get blamed. So he writes The City of God, which I think is a number of volumes, and writes it over a period of years, and eventually, I think, finishes it up soon before he dies, actually. He also writes Defending the Faith Against the Donatists and against Pelagius, who was another guy who we won't get into. I probably would have agreed with him more on some things than Augustine, but not everything. He is the one that came up with the just war theory. This is why I'm saying his influence was great on the church and the Catholic Church. The whole two swords idea. Remember when Jesus asked his disciples, so how many swords do we have? And they said two. And he said, that's enough. And Augustine would have taken that to mean that, okay, we've got the sword of the word and we've got the sword of steel. And we can use both of them. That's quite a stretch from that writing. Another one of the verses that was stretched was the idea when Jesus talks about the wedding feast and he says, well, go out to the highways and byways and compel them to come in. Oh, so you can compel somebody to be a Christian and you might have to use a sword of steel to do it. So that's where some of these ideas come from. He was very strong on total depravity, and if you look at the believings of the Manichaeans, you'll see where some of that's coming through because of the flesh and the evilness of the creation and the flesh and so forth. And when we talk about total depravity, I'm talking about the kind of total depravity that the Calvinist would see as where you have no power in yourself whatsoever to come to God. Now, we would say, no, we can't get saved on our own, but we would say we have a choice in the matter, that we have to choose. Prior to Augustine, I want to make this very clear. Prior to Augustine, from what I understand, and I haven't read them all, but the early church fathers would have all written that we have a free will to choose. And it's by our choices that we make of whether or not we're saved or not. After Augustine, that changes drastically because of his total depravity and how he viewed man and man's ability to come to God at all. That we have nothing in it, basically. Calvin picked up much on his writings and would have used it in his theology. He also clarifies some things on the sacraments, and some of that's done through his writings about the Donatist. He is infant baptism. He explains that and why that's necessary and so forth. It's not that it was not happening before he was around, but he clarifies and gives it legitimacy. And many would call him the father of the Catholic Church as we know it today. And so there you have Augustine. Other things that led up to the Reformation, you had a renaissance in about the 12th century. That's not the actual renaissance that we think about with the Enlightenment. That comes later. But you had that you had an increase in science and knowledge. One of the things about the increase in science, and I don't think I have it in here, is after the sacking of Rome and so forth, a lot of science and a lot of that knowledge just kind of got lost. A lot of the knowledge now that's getting picked up now is because of the expansion of the Muslim world. And you might not realize this or not, but back then, a lot of great scientists and philosophers and thinkers actually came out of the Islamic world. And even, I think, the Kalam cosmological theory and so forth regarding creation, some of those, I think, come from them and so forth. They were quite the thinkers. And some of that starts getting its influence into the Christian world and into that world. One of the things after the discovery of the Americas is they decided that, oh, maybe the world's not flat after all. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters when you have a church that is basically persecuting anyone that says it's not flat and says the Bible proves it's flat. It seems to be round, like a ball. Okay, if the church is wrong about earth, what else is it wrong about? Do you see these questions that start coming into people's mind? Science increases, knowledge increases, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, there's a whole other world out there that we didn't even know about. The church didn't know about it. The world is not flat. There are people and worlds previously unknown to Europe that they didn't know about. And then the biggest one probably is the invention of the printing press. So Johannes Gutenberg, in about AD 1439, he invents the printing press. Now, there had been some better printing methods going on in China and other places for a long time, but he actually is the one that puts together the printing press. And in 1452, he prints the Gutenberg Bible, and it's a Latin Bible. And they could do about 250 sheets per hour instead of handwriting every page over and over and over and over and over and over. And this I found interesting. As of now, there's about 49. I think he had printed maybe several hundred. I don't know. But anyway, there's about 49 of these that survived. 21 of them are complete. And it is considered to be the most expensive, the most valuable book on earth, if you have one. If you find one, let me know. I'll buy it off of you for a few bucks. They actually don't know what they're worth because the last one that sold, I think, sold in about the late 70s. They don't really know how much they're worth. There's one at, if any of you ever seen the one in the Library of Congress in Washington, got one person here that's seen that well, two. My wife's seen it back there. This is what Gutenberg said. It is a press, certainly, but a press from which shall flow inexhaustible streams. Through it, God will spread his word. A spring of truth shall flow from it. Like a new star, it shall scatter the darkness of ignorance and cause a light heretofore unknown to shine amongst men. If you think the internet has changed the last 20 years, the printing press probably did more at that time over a period of time, because suddenly people could actually write and print, and suddenly Bibles and little booklets and tracts and all kinds of things was getting out there, which had a great influence. This is probably the thing that helped push the Reformation on, because people could actually get Bibles in their language. People could get other books. People could get a lot of things. Early proponents of change, you have Wycliffe, John Wycliffe. He's called the morning star of the Reformation. You've probably heard about him. He wants to translate and does, for the most part, an English Bible so that people could actually have the Bible in English. He has a group of people that follow him called the Lullards. And the Lullards are men that go around and preach on the streets. Preaching was not really kind of a thing back then so much. They might have called it more lectures. But he had this group of Lullards, and they would go around preaching and teaching. I should have mentioned it. It's in your books, actually. Erasmus would have been a little bit earlier than Wycliffe, I believe, or around that period. He's mentioned in there. He was a born-again Catholic priest, is what kind of what they would have said. He didn't leave the Catholic Church. There wasn't really much to go to yet at that point. He was, but he was also a proponent and of change within the Catholic Church. So Wycliffe dies a natural death. He managed to die a natural death, but he's burned at the stake 25 years later. And you're wondering now, wait a minute, I thought he died a natural death. Well, he did. But his teachings and his the Lullards and his teaching and the English Bible and stuff continue to affect the church. And finally, after 25 years, they go and they dig up his bones. That's about all that was left, his bones. And from what I understand, they wired his skeleton back together and tied it into a chair so they could have a trial. And they tried him and found him guilty of heresy and strapped his bones to a post and burned him at the stake. And then scattered his ashes on the river, I believe. You say, well, that doesn't make any sense. No, to us it does not. But if you believe the church has the right to basically put people in heaven or hell, now suddenly it makes a difference. I believe it was Beechey that said he hopes that God let him watch that from heaven just so he could see the foolishness. No, I don't know if that would be a good idea or not. But you can see the tensions beginning to build within the Catholic Church. You see these people that are starting to say, this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't right. And then the church starting to crack down and saying, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do if you go against us. You have John Huss, who was from 1370 to 1415. And you'll notice these guys are quite a while before the actual Reformation. Some of these guys. He was born again. He was a born-again Catholic priest as well. He condemned some of the practices of the church. He was actually burned at the stake. He was tried and burned at the stake. I want to talk just a little bit about that. So he was guaranteed by the Pope and had the seal of the Pope on the paper. He was guaranteed safe travel to and from, I believe it was Constance. If you come to the trial, we want to hear what you're having to say. We don't agree with you. We want to have a trial. We want to hear. We'll guarantee you safe passage there and back. And somewhere outside of the city, they caught him and threw him in jail. And he shows the jailer or whoever was there his papers. He said, right here, I have my papers. This guarantees me it's the Pope's. And they yank his papers away and they say the church has no need to honor anything that we say to heretics. In other words, we can lie to you all we want, and there's nothing wrong with it. That's what you see as far as the state church at this time. But he was one of those early ones. Martin Luther, on the other hand, comes on the scene. He lives from 1483 to 1546, and he went to law school originally, and he leaves law school to join a monastic order, becoming a what? An Augustinian friar. You think he might learn a little bit about Augustine's beliefs? I think so. He was part of that culture, and that's where he learned a lot of things. Quite likely why he didn't take some of the steps that the Anabaptists did to completely leave some of the beliefs that he had. He was ordained in 1507, and he was troubled by his own guilt, and he visits Rome in 1510. Now, it starts talking about him here in your books, and you can look at that if you'd like, on page 13, I believe. One of the things that he was frustrated with, we're going to jump on here. Well, let's talk about that visit to Rome. So one of the things he did, he took a pilgrimage to Rome, and we're going to talk just a little bit about the whole thing of indulgences. But one of the things that could earn you a few indulgences was if you traveled to Rome or you did some kind of pilgrimage, and supposedly at Rome there was these steps that led, I forget where they led up to, supposedly they were the actual steps that were before the Pilate's throne or bema there in Jerusalem where Jesus was tried, and supposedly they had gotten picked up and hauled to Rome, maybe by Constantine's mother, I'm thinking, maybe, I don't know, somebody got him to Rome, and then you could go and crawl up those. And if I understand right, he crawled up those on his knees in penance, trying, because he felt this weight of guilt that just wouldn't lift. He didn't understand how to get rid of it. And somewhere, I think, in that process is where he actually suddenly dawned on him, we are justified by faith. Romans says we're justified by faith, which started his looking and studying at that. But he was very frustrated with the corruption that he saw in the church. If I understand correctly, at that time, if you would go out and visit the normal people in the community, the normal church-going people, many of them were thin. They didn't have much money. They couldn't pay their taxes, their heavy taxes. The taxes went to take care of the priests and the popes, or the pope and the priests and the cardinals and the nuns and all these religious people and their families, if they had any. And they often struggled with obesity, while the common person struggled with starvation. You see how some of these underlying things, it was ready to blow. There was tension. It was ready to blow. And one of the ways that they made money was through the selling of indulgences. And you'll see, if you look in your book on page 13 as well, it says there in the second paragraph, pardoners traveled the country selling indulgences and sometimes making unauthorized promises in order to increase their sales. Promises such as pardon for future sins or immediate relief from purgatory. Johann Tetzel, one such pardoner, was said to have advertised, as soon as a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. Wow. If you thought somebody in your family was in purgatory, what would you do? Yeah. They claim not, but so you're saying you hear that it's still being, yeah. Yeah. Well, and I know, I saw this in Mexico when we were down there one time, out in the middle of nowhere, little huts where people could go and put coins and money. Was that a thing in Central America, Kevin, that you would have seen? You don't know? and put coins and money in there. Yeah, so it's still basically going on then, to some extent. So this was going on. As a matter of fact, Luther, and one of his things with his pilgrimage, he was thinking perhaps he could get his grandfather, I think it was, out of purgatory. Where did purgatory come from? Well, it didn't come from the Bible, but they had to come up with some kind of an idea where souls go who have not lived perfectly and not lived a good righteous life before they can actually go to heaven. And so you go to a place of suffering or torment or so forth. And some of these guys, when they were selling indulgences, were basically, they'd get up and they'd say, can't you just hear your family members crying out to you, give, give, to get us out of this torture and whatever. And a number of these people, like Huss and those, they were frustrated with this selling it because they saw the abuse of it. The selling of indulgences basically went to build and to do whatever they wanted to in the church. And so purgatory was a thing that had come into the church, and selling indulgence would help you get out of purgatory basically faster. Justification by faith and not works was something that Martin Luther came to understand. And so he nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg in 1517, which talks a little bit about in our book. And then we have Ulrich Zwingli, who I'm not going to get into today, although he is talked about in the book here, but I want to talk about him a little bit more 2 weeks from now when we talk about him and his direct contact with the Anabaptist and what they believed. So you see there's a number of things that are actually from the time of Constantine up through for over 1,000 years as the church goes through a lot of different turmoil, obviously. Because of the fall of the Roman Empire, you didn't have, the state was no longer quite the same as it had been before. And in many cases, in many areas, the church itself had kind of become the state and ruled itself. And you had leaders that actually would beg for forgiveness or that they wouldn't be put out of the church because of fear of going to purgatory or to hell, and so forth. During that time, and eventually you start to see these awakenings. And again, a lot of those other things that I mentioned, secular things, greatly affected the people and their thinking about what's going on in the church. And so there's a number of people, but Luther, of course, becomes a big one, and what he does. In your books, you'll notice on page 13 there at the bottom, the five things that Luther talks about in his Reformation, and I may not pronounce all of these perfectly, but you'll see down there, solo fide, faith alone, solo scriptura, scripture alone, solus Christus, Christ alone, sola gratia, grace alone, and soli Deo gloria, the glory of God alone. However, what's interesting is they talk about some of those things like Scripture alone, but then when you actually look at some of their unwillingness to put away some of the doctrines that they had learned from the Catholic Church, it's like, wait a minute, if it's Scripture alone, but that is actually kind of what moved the Anabaptists to the position that they had was, yes, we have to go back to the Scripture, and we have to go back to the early church. And we're not going to just base our ideas on Augustine or other writers of that sort. Okay, there's a number of questions in the back here in your book, and I had hoped to get here about 5 minutes sooner than I did. And there's also a page 16. There's a number of things there you might really want to read. I'd like to look at some things on page 15 in the next lesson. So you might be thinking about that if I don't forget. I will say this. On page 16, there is one thing I want to mention. The next to the last paragraph. Ironically, some Anabaptist teachings about church later came to be embraced by other groups. These included separation of church and state, voluntary church membership, church discipline of unrepentant sinners, and believers' baptism, though some mainline Protestant denominations continue to practice infant baptism. the Anabaptists, their beliefs affected other denominations over a period of time. They came to believe and see maybe they were right. And at some point, I'd like to talk a little bit about how that affected the Constitution of the United States of America. Think about that. Think about what the Anabaptists believed, and think about where we're at, and think about the fact that not all the early colonies had a freedom of religion like we think about it in the United States. And maybe we'll take a look at that at some point. But just thinking about the effect that it had. So there are, they did come to understand a lot of that, but there are still a lot of differences in how we view things like non-resistance and the effects of justification, along with applying New Testament scriptures. Some of those things are still quite blurred between Anabaptist understandings and Protestant evangelical understandings, and especially when you get into like a Lutheran church and a Reformed church, so forth. So on page 18, there's a number of questions there. I don't know if you had looked at those. I find some of those interesting. Does anybody have a question or a comment or something you'd like to share or something you want to hear discussed at this point? There's a lot of history known in there. It was really the height of the Dark Ages in a lot of ways. And if I could sum up that period maybe a little bit, is you see a continual building of what I would call heretical views in the church, and the hierarchy continues to expand in a sense, and abusive practices like the indulgences and all this kind of stuff, and then you just see a darkness across a lot of these areas. Now you also have the Crusades that happened during that. We didn't talk at all about the Crusades. I would have liked to have spent a little time talking about that, but I didn't think I had time. And by the way, how many of you know that you have Yoder blood in you somewhere? I know Richard does. Obviously, Valita. There's a few of you. Okay. I believe, from some things I've read about the Yoder family line, they think they know who the first Anabaptist was, but they also say they believe. I don't remember when I was reading this exactly what evidence they have, but they think there was at least a Yoder that was involved in the Crusades as well. So we don't have all the prettiest stuff in our background. Anyway. So that would have been one of the things that happened during that period. There was a lot of fighting between the Muslims and the church at that time. That's what brought the Crusades about. If you go into North Africa, where it's like some of these Donatists and some of these Arius people were that were a little bit on the edge, one of the reasons they died out during that time was because the Muslims began to take over North Africa and just kind of pushed them out. And because of a lot of the infighting there between some of the different groups, they didn't hold up real well. And so those were some of the things that happened. I don't know that history that great, but those were just some things that happened during that time.
To the start of the church to where we're at today, and that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Now, going through this.
Yeah.
It kind of puts a connection of the start of the church to up to all the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a connection all the way through there. Yeah.
It's something that actually happened.
Yeah, yeah, it did. And it's amazing, Richard, you talked about like that, maybe from the 600s up to the 1200s, like what was going on. And if you think about it, think of all the people that lived and died in the church that couldn't read, couldn't write, And all they knew was what they were told by their church leaders. And many of those church leaders actually did not study that much themselves. They just went off of whatever they had been told. And so there were millions of people probably in the church that lived and died. And I'm thankful that God is the judge and knows what was in those people's heart, because they couldn't pick up a Bible and read it like we can. And even like the early church, many of those early church fathers had scriptures they could get to. And by the time you get into the Dark Ages, many of them couldn't read, couldn't write, and didn't have a Bible. And which is one of the wonderful things about the Gutenberg Press, was that suddenly people could have Bibles again. We are blessed, yeah. Yeah, and you talked about reading the Bible through this year, and we often don't read the Bible as much as we should, and yet if you go back, like one of the Bibles that was translated into English was called, I forget what it was called now, it's not coming to me, but it would basically be at the, you'd have to go to the church, and it was actually like chained to the church so people couldn't steal it, but people would go there and spend hours reading if they could and wait for somebody else to get done, and yet we've got them just laying at home. We don't have to, in America, we don't have to die to have one. Some places today, right now, if you have one, you could die for it. Somebody else have a question or a comment or something you'd like to share?
One thing I thought about, the question number 6, when you talk about how we view other Christians.
Mm-hmm.
We can sometimes get caught up in our lane differences, but these differences that were in the Reformation were huge, like dishonesty and persecution and all kinds of, like, they were really huge deals, way different than what separates us today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, maybe this is helpful for me to see that maybe some of our disagreements are not a big deal.
I think when you get into some belief systems, it becomes a big deal because of what's the underlying and what actually is the outworking of it. But you're right. Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You are very right. I don't have to worry about, at least I haven't yet, had to worry about walking down the streets of Goshen and either having maybe a Mennonite who is much more progressive than I am in their belief system grab me and kill me, or a Catholic, or a Baptist, or a Lutheran, or someone say, well, we're going to kill you because you're a Mennonite and we don't like you. So, yeah, you're right. It looks much different. In a sense, our differences are certainly different than what they were at the time of the Reformation and the outworkings of that. Yeah. But what's interesting is, so my question might be back is, so what would I die for today? And I'd like to look at that as we go on through this. What beliefs that I have and convictions would I die for today compared to what our early Anabaptist forefathers died for? And we'll talk about that more in the next lesson. Anyone else? A question or something? I appreciate the thoughts and questions.
That there is a difference. We would agree a lot more with some churches in our community than others. And one of the big things is what the Anabaptists would like to do. They're not just believers' baptism.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
We can't fellowship with someone who believes in the baptism. That is a red line.
Yeah.
We should never feel comfortable fellowshipping with them because it goes right down to the root of, are we truly believing in Christ for our salvation and believing in our baptism?
Mm-hmm.
6 weeks old.
Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me. Believer's baptism, of course, yeah, was the big one then, and it still should be. Yeah. Someone else. We got... You're saying, how did you start that now?
They were out promoting what they
believed. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If we were out on the streets of Goshen Where would we be?
So I have done that, Jerry. We work for a lot of very liberal, progressive Mennonite people in right in Goshen, and I have done that very thing. And yeah, we walked on 6th Street about a year ago. You see me and the guy got a very interesting conversation. The difference is that they are not militant in what they're doing. And so they're open-minded enough that they can allow me to still exist. Whether that's good or bad,
I'm not sure. They just don't care.
Oh, he cared, but it was just like, well, if that's how you want to believe, you know. In other words, I'm not going to convince him, and he's not going to convince me necessarily. But I mean, we had a good, it was a civil conversation, but I confronted him on some things, and yeah, he didn't try to kill me. But I think there's much more of an open-mindedness now. For good or bad, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
That allows us to exist.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, quick question, and maybe this will change as we go along, but a quick question for you. Would you like more time for questions and discussion than what I'm giving you? I've tried to get a lot crammed into a couple of lessons here, and hopefully that'll change a little bit, but, or maybe you just want to come to me and tell me on straight out. I'll throw that out there. You can let me know. If I'm yakking too long and we don't get enough time for discussion, I just want to know it. So, okay, you are dismissed. We'll see you back here shortly.